On Capitol Hill, getting past all the hatred and stupidity.
Here's this problem. People really hate you, and they're starting to hate us because we're hanging out with you. And you have to help us deal with that. You have to avoid being stupid.
Hanging out or just hanging the bankers. Congressman Barney Frank's gallows humor was one part of the entertainment in yesterday's hearings as bank CEOs faced the music.
Everybody crying mercy when they don't know the meaning of the word.
Mercy, mercy, bankers cry uncle on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Uncle! Just call me Uncle John Hockenberry. Good morning. Daljeet Dhaliwal is in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Daljeet.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everybody. And today we're going to discuss the final draft of that stimulus bill, the relationship between the Players Union and A-Rod, and the future of the NAACP, which turns 100 years old today. First, the headlines.
Call it the little stimulus bill that could, or rather the massive one. The revised plan weighs in at $789 billion. Congressional negotiators hammered out a final agreement yesterday. Republican Senator Olympia Snow of Maine says the plan will ultimately help the country recover from the recession.
It wasn't a matter of what constituted spending provisions or what was tax relief. The question is, what works for this country?
A final vote would work could be today in the House. Investors around the world seem to have their doubts about how much the plan can provide. Japan's Nikkei index went down more than 3% today. All major European indices followed suit, and Wall Street appears poised for a lower opening. Daljeet?
Pakistan announced today that it has several suspects from the Mumbai terrorist attacks in custody. Pakistani senior official Rahman Malik says that the country is making every effort to investigate the conspiracy.
We have gone extra mile because that has to be done, and that proves our sincerity, commitment against this act of terrorism.
It's the country's first admission of their role in the November attacks. Kabul is stepping up its security ahead of a visit today from the U.S.'s special envoy to the region. Richard Holbrooke is scheduled to arrive there today. His visit comes a day after a Taliban assault on government buildings in Kabul left at least 28 people dead.
In about an hour and a half, Wall Street will get a chance to deliver a verdict on the stimulus package. But ladies and gentlemen, we have a stimulus bill. Start your engines, won't you?
Hi, my name is Grace Linus, and I'm calling from Atlanta, Georgia. I am calling because I'd like to see some of that stimulus money go towards sidewalks throughout Atlanta. I hate to see women walking with their children on the sides of the roads and then standing at a bus stop that has no pavement to it, so they're standing in the grass.
That is a great suggestion. I've been to Atlanta. I know exactly what she's talking about. Tell us your suggestion for this $789 billion. We're deputizing you to give us suggestions and also to investigate how your money is being spent. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, February 12th. I am John Hockenberry. Daljeet Dhaliwal is in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Daljeet.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everybody. Now,
I don't know about you, but I feel really stimulated by $789 billion
you
in
do?
The morning.
Yeah, are you getting a share of it?
We've got a stimulus package, and we are mobilizing all of you. You've been watching, Daljeet, the president going around to these various construction sites around the country, possible sites where stimulus money would be spent. We're doing the same sort of thing, only we're mobilizing our listeners to call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org and suggest improvements and projects in your own neighborhoods like this listener did.
My name is Scott Berg, and I'm calling from West Valley City, Utah, where we could really use a lot of work on our local baseball field, our kids' diamonds, and our roads need some work, seriously. And that would be great.
That's a great suggestion, and we're going to, later on in the program with Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway's own Andrea Bernstein, assess the likelihood of this stimulus package actually taking care of any of the projects that you have suggested at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. But first, we have a bill. What's actually in it? As I said, $789 billion. That's a bit lower than the original House and Senate versions. What's in the bill, Daljeet?
Well, let's break it down. I mean, the details are still coming in, John, but here's what we know. Here's what lawmakers are telling us. We've got $507 billion for those spending programs, $282 billion in tax relief, and that...
That's a chunk of change.
Yeah. But it's a scaled-back version of President Obama's middle-class tax cut proposal. And then there's a one-time payment of $250 billion, and that's going to go to $250, rather. That's maybe giving away way too much, but that's going to go to Social Security and disability support. Mm-hmm. And then there's $150 billion that's earmarked for public works projects like transportation, energy, of course, which is a big favorite of the president, something that he talks about quite often in terms of job creation. And then we've got technology and $87 billion to help states meet the rising cost of Medicaid.
And the $87 billion Medicaid provision was something that Republicans really were against. We should just sort of remind people that under this bill, the maximum a family could get in tax relief would be $800. And I guess if you're on Social Security, $250 plus $800, you know, you're a little over $1,000. We'll find out as the details emerge who's actually eligible for all of that. But what's not in the bill, Mr. Negative over here, I'll give you a rundown of that. $25 billion was slashed from a proposed state fiscal stabilization fund. That's to help states with their own deficits. $16 billion in line items was eliminated for new school construction.
And that was also a very contentious area as well.
And
so
it was something Obama definitely wanted. That was on his wish list.
But schools are going to get repaired.
Schools are going to get repaired, but there's not going to be new construction. And spending was sharply curtailed to provide health insurance for the unemployed. And lawmakers also reduced the Senate's proposed tax incentives for buyers of homes and cars, which was a pretty popular detail as it was emerging in the debate, but that's no longer in the bill. And all these details came after very tough negotiations between lawmakers in the House and Senate. Joining us to talk about how those talks went is Todd Zwillick, our very own Todd Zwillick, who was in the conference committee meeting yesterday. He's on Capitol Hill this morning. Todd, thanks for joining us.
Hey, John. How are you?
So tough talk, and it seemed like it was on again, off again at certain points yesterday. And by the way, Todd, meet Daljeet Dhaliwal here.
Hello, Todd.
Hi, Daljeet. Hi.
Hello.
So how did it go?
Good. We've met. Okay.
How did it begin? Yep. There we go.
Well, well, how did it begin? This began right after, actually even before this bill passed the Senate on Tuesday, when I was up in New York with you all. This bill passed, and negotiations between House and Senate Democrats and just a smattering of Republicans actually passed before the bill even passed the Senate, because it was after a certain point, it was a done deal. So then talks went late into the night on Tuesday night with Rahm Emanuel, White House Chief of Staff, Peter Orszag, the White House Budget Director, House and Senate leaders, staff, senior staff, and members, going all the way up until midnight. And then finally yesterday, in the afternoon, actually late in the morning, senators started to trickle out of a meeting in Harry Reid's office. Max Baucus was the first one out of the room, and he got a crowd of reporters around him right outside Harry Reid's leadership office in an area where reporters actually aren't supposed to. We're allowed to go through, but we're not supposed to linger because the security guards don't like it. But they let us in there because Baucus was there. So listen to this. Here's how he came out with the news.
There are the votes are there for passage. That is clear.
Okay.
That is clear.
The way it stands right now.
Yes, correct. And I know it will not change.
Is there an agreement on the top line number?
Yeah.
What is it?
789.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. 789.
Is it 789 or 789.5? I've heard a couple of
times. I don't know.
What's a half a billion between friends, right?
There's an exasperation there and a lack of precision there. Is that because of the size of the bill or the contentiousness of the negotiations?
Probably the exhaustion of the senator,
right?
I think that's what you're hearing in his voice. Max Baucus is his chairman of the Finance Committee, and he has been hard at this for weeks, going on to months. All of the tax provisions go through his committee. You're right. It's contentious. Length of negotiation, size of the bill, and very tired senators, and that's to say nothing for how tired the staff are. They're the ones who stay up all night drafting the language. And so you mentioned you don't have a whole lot of information. You went through the top lines there,
right?
Earlier in the segment, and that's really all we have right now. And that got a little contentious.
Let me back you up for one second, because it's not clear to me after all of this coverage what the real issue between the Senate and the House lawmakers was in terms of their differences.
Well, it came down to a couple of things. One is the overall size of the bill, that top line number. We're at 789. The House passed about 820. The Senate passed 838, I guess, 839. And a lot of Democrats, especially progressives, wanted more money in this bill. A lot of economists say the size of the bill really matters. You've got a $2.1 trillion hole in the economy, and what you're really doing is backfilling it. So the size of the bill, the amount you spend either in spending or tax cuts, really does make a difference, that bottom line number. So they wanted it bigger. They just wanted it bigger. Also, the mix. A lot of Democrats, you wouldn't be surprised, would like more spending compared to less tax cuts. There's also a couple of other issues. This AMT, we've talked about it before, the alternative minimum tax, that's worth $70 billion in the agreement. That was a Senate initiative. They go through this every year, and every year it's sort of the same dynamic. It's very easy for the Senate to do it. A lot of House members don't like this patch because it's not paid for. This got thrown into the stimulus. It's not stimulative. Nobody says it does. The politicians kind of saved themselves a lot of worry later in the year by attaching it to this train that's leaving the station, you see. And so they don't have to have this fight later on because Everybody knows the stimulus has to pass. So a lot of House members don't like the fact that the AMT's on there. There's not much they can do about it at this point.
Any Republican voices that stood out to you yesterday?
Well, yeah, a couple. And we have to go to the conference committee. So you heard Max Baucus come out of that meeting. And then a couple of hours later at 3 o'clock, it was time for the official conference committee to convene. Now, this was pretty much a pro forma session because the bill had been negotiated between Democrats and those three Senate Republicans who helped pass the bill. The rank-and-file Republicans, the Republican leadership, they were not part of this deal. To the extent they were invited, they didn't show up. But for the most part, they weren't invited. They never were. They were locked out of this. So the conference committee went to convene, and everyone's supposed to be there. But the House Democrats didn't show up. They didn't show up because when Harry Reid came out and announced they had a deal shortly after you heard Max Baucus say 789, this was not signed off on by Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats, and they were not happy.
The Senate upstaged the House.
Yeah, well, they upstaged them, and they were not happy about a couple of issues. So everyone showed up from the conference committee. I was in there, and Republicans were left sitting at the table, and the House Democrats just didn't show up. So I had a word with Jerry Lewis. He's the ranking Republican on the House Appropriations Committee and a Republican conferee. And here's what he had to say about being stood up.
Yeah, we come here to negotiate the conference between the two houses and the parties. They were somewhere else negotiating behind closed doors. Their problems.
That doesn't sound very organized there, that's for sure.
It's not. They showed up a couple of hours later. They had a quick conference committee. And then a lot of complaints. You said the details of this plan have not emerged. And it's worth mentioning that last night after this pro forma conference committee for the TV cameras was all done, nobody had any paper. Press, staff, even members, nobody knew exactly what was in this bill. And Republican offices started firing off angry letters saying, $800 billion, I think we would like to know what's in it. Maybe the taxpayers would like to know. And that led to a response from several House and Senate senior members saying, we're not trying to hoodwink anybody. It's a 800-page bill. Give us some time. We're working all night. We're not sleeping. We'll get it out there.
Well, Todd, in conclusion, I guess it's fair to say that after all of the economic discussion of what's a stimulus package, what's not, this really wasn't about economics. It was more about arithmetic, a number that these lawmakers could be comfortable with, and $800 billion they weren't comfortable with, but $789 apparently they are. It's a number they kind of pulled out of a hat. The details will come later. Todd Zwillick, reporter for Capital News Connection, thanks so much for being a fly on the wall there.
Pleasure.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I am John Hockenberry here with Daljit Dhaliwal, who's in for Adora Udoji. Daljit.
Hello.
Hello, hello. I need to disclose something here. We're going to talk about a big takeaway story, and that is, of course, the steroid controversy. Alex Rodriguez admitting after it was reported in SI that he used steroids, three-time most valuable player winner and arguably the best player in baseball. Huge sports story. It's been bouncing all over the city of New York. I just want to disclose.
A lot of people asking, you know, who could be next, right?
Right, right. Exactly. I mean, if it's Alex, it's got to be anybody at this point. But my feeling is, and I want to just disclose this right at the top, I don't care about steroids. I mean, I don't care if people use them. I don't think it's cheating. The technology that we have in all kinds of sports makes it just absurd that we're going to compare Alex Rodriguez with somebody three or four generations ago. The things aren't comparable. If you want to take that kind of risk with your own health and use steroids, I'm fine with it. I don't think it's cheating, but I think listeners ought
okay,
to
Okay, so why don't
that.
You tell us what you really think now?
But the takeaway from this story is, what was the origin of these tests that basically outed Alex Rodriguez? And here to talk about that is Michael Schmidt, a reporter for The New York Times. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And it appears that the players' union was the source of these test results. And I guess if the players' union is supposed to be protecting players, in this particular instance, Alex Rodriguez, who has reserved a lot of anger for Selena Roberts, who broke this story for SI, maybe he should have some anger for the players' union, which really seems to have botched it here in some sense. They held on to these results. It's not clear why. Now they've come to light. Alex Rodriguez's career is really in jeopardy. What do you make of all this as far as the union's complicity?
In 2003, all players were tested on an anonymous survey basis. No one was supposed to know the results of what happened. At the end of the season, if more than 5% tested positive, they'd go to penalty back testing the following season. As soon as they made that decision, they could destroy the tests. As soon as they realized there was more than 5%, they could destroy the test. What happened was there's a six-day period between when they decided to go to when they realized they had to go to penalty back testing and when the federal government subpoenaed them as part of the Balco investigation. So in that six-day period, they were not destroyed, which baseball officials blamed the union for because it was the union's job to destroy them. The union has since said they had begun the process to destroy the tests, but that they weren't. The government came in and later got them.
Well, let me get this straight as far as from the perspective of an actual player. The union came to the players and said, okay, this is a voluntary initiative. We are going to do testing of players. It's going to be completely confidential. We guarantee you that. You don't have to be a part of the testing if you don't want to. They took these results, and then first they didn't destroy them, and the confidentiality has gone out the window.
There was an enormous amount of pressure in 2002 for baseball to do something about drugs. The union had stonewalled the commissioner's office for several years, and the agreement that they reached was anonymous survey testing. Mm-hmm. More than 5%. We're going to penalty back testing the following season. So that was the agreement in place. I don't think the union tried to hurt their players or whatever. Some people accuse the union of being lazy and sort of lackadaisical for allowing that six-day period to go on and to not destroy the tests before the government asked for them.
Would they have been subject to obstruction of justice charges if they destroyed them, knowing, perhaps suspecting, that a subpoena was coming?
If they suspected a subpoena was coming and they destroyed them, they could – there is some legal grounds that the government could have taken. But from what I've learned so far, there was – they didn't learn about it until the 19th of November, I believe. So they were sort of just kind of waiting to get rid of them.
So it's unclear why they were holding on to the test results.
Well, they said that they began the process of destroying them. But as I learned 2 days ago and we reported – all they had to do was make a phone call.
Just want to back up a little bit. So some of the players took these tests knowing that the results would be positive, and they still went ahead and did these tests?
They were told their results. They would never know the results of their own results, and no one else was supposed to know the results of their tests.
Well, that's the $215 million question for Alex
Rodriguez.
They knew
the results of their results.
Well, if they knew they were taking steroids, they could probably conclude what their result was, but the testers never told them. The union didn't tell the individual players whether they had tested positive or not, right?
Correct. That was only till later. I mean, what makes this such an interesting story is that the test gets seized, and then the union a year later goes back and tells the players, the government has your test. And that's how Rodriguez finds out in 2004 that his test has been seized.
So how are people feeling about the fact that the union did this? I mean, are they blaming the players' union?
Baseball blames the union. The union has had little to say about it. They said they started the process of destroying them. And Alex Rodriguez hasn't really addressed the issue.
You know, the question on sports radio here in the New York market and really around the country, insofar as I've been able to observe, is that there appears to be a consensus. Baseball owners don't care about this at all. It's really between Congress and the players. As far as the owner's concerned, this is just more entertainment. Do you buy that?
No, I think the commissioner's office takes this issue very seriously. I think Bud Selig takes this issue very seriously. I think he realizes that his legacy is in part tied to this, and I think he's been very aggressive at trying to address it. A lot of people have criticized him, but I think he's really tried to do something.
Michael Schmidt, reporter for the New York Times, thanks so much for joining us on this story. The union's complicity, one way or another, in the tests that outed A-Rod in the steroid controversy, part of a very, very big story here in New York and around the sports world as the baseball season inches closer to spring training. Mark Garrison, you have the headlines.
Thank you, John. It's 28 minutes after the hour. I'll add something on that drugs and sports story you were just talking about.
Please.
Just hours after the SI story about A-Rod steroid use came out, I got a press release from the MLB Network. That's the cable channel the league owns. And they said, right tonight, Bob Costas is going to interview the reporter who broke the story. I was actually surprised because you would expect kind of a whitewash of the steroid story. But if you go to their channel, they've been covering it a lot. Their website, you can read about A-Rod and Miguel Tejada's guilty plea. A lot of placement there. So they're kind of in the journalism business, but they're trying to, you know, in cover this, but also as he talked about in the interview, show that they do care about this for the fans. So it's kind of interesting to see if they'll actually stay on that story and actually be aggressive covering it in their outlets. So we'll see. In the Capitol, a vote could come today on the economic stimulus package. Lawmakers reconciled the different House and Senate versions of the bill last night in committee. The now $789 billion package includes tax credits and new spending for roads and bridges, unemployment insurance, and health care. Around 40% of the bill will fund tax cuts. 60% is new spending. The president continues traveling in support of the plan. He'll be in Peoria, Illinois today. Scientists are keeping an eye out on some orbiting space debris after two communications satellites smash into each other above Earth. The collision between the U.S. and Russian satellites occurred earlier in the week. NASA says it's the first-of-a-kind crash, and it believes the International Space Station should be safe, but they're watching out. It could take weeks to determine the full scope of that. Also, a big acquisition.
It's like a bully satellite? It's
well,
like
a no, bully. They were nice. Just a little accident.
Russian
the Russian
satellites.
Was actually out of service. It wasn't working, and it just, boom, hit it like that. So that's what happened. Also, just a quick note, Chinalco, that's China's state-owned aluminum producer. They're investing $20 billion in Rio Tinto, the beach go.
Well, that's a huge
company.
Story.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. $789 billion or more or less, on its way to an economy near you. That's the stimulus bill, which is probably going to achieve final passage in Washington today. We are evaluating that stimulus package in a unique way. We're taking suggestions from listeners all over the country and assessing whether the projects you suggest have a chance of being part of this stimulus bill. Andrea Bernstein is going to join us later in the hour and talk about those. But you can call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're actually doing something that the president is also doing. He's traveling to various places that might be a site of the stimulus package and infrastructure spending and giving speeches there. We're mobilizing you to give the speeches directly on our program. Here is Barack Obama speaking last July on a subject maybe equally as important, but very, very different.
You know, it is always humbling to speak before the NAACP because it's a powerful reminder of the debt that we all owe to those who marched for us and fought for us and stood up on our behalf.
But of course, his candidate, Barack Obama, speaking on the 99th anniversary of the NAACP. The NAACP turns 100 today. And joining us to talk about that is Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor of Essence Magazine and Takeaway contributor. You know, some have described the ascension of Barack Obama as a changing of the guard in the civil rights movement. But there, hearing him speak, he's very, very conscious of both looking backward and looking forward in terms of leadership in the African-American community.
Good morning, John. His ascendancy would be impossible without the NAACP, which was founded on February 12th, which happens to be Abraham Lincoln's birthday and was purposeful when the NAACP was started in 1909, largely by W.E.B. Du Bois and a group of African-Americans and non-African-Americans who are part of the Niagara movement. They actually met in 1905 in Niagara Falls. Guess why, John? Because no hotels in the United States would house them, you know. So when the NAACP started, it really was focused on legislation, especially the 14th Amendment. And some of the greatest highlights of the NAACP revolved around legislation, especially its NAACP Legal Defense Fund, who, of course, you know, one of the most iconic names is Thurgood Marshall, who argued successfully in Brown versus Board of Education, which ended legal segregation in schools. But some of the other members of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund that people forget who were members or who were lawyers there were Deval Patrick, Eric Holder was
governor of Massachusetts.
Absolutely. Marion Wright Edelman, Lonnie Guinier, the first African-American tenured Harvard law professor, Elaine Jones. And that's what people should talk about when they talk about the NAACP. The organization had it stumbled a bit in the 80s. They weren't prepared for the backlash they were going to get with the Reagan administration's Justice Department. And when they stumbled badly and sort of hard and sort of lost their footing.
Well, before we talk about the stumble, let's zip back in time 100 years. As you describe, I think, in your sort of opening sentence there, and I just want to make sure people remember it, this was a coalition of sort of people with sort of abolitionist roots in the white community and African nationalist, African, you know, sort of advocates of various kinds come together in one organization. From that coalition beginning, where did the NAACP evolve to? And then before the stumble, why was it unprepared for what happened during the Reagan era?
Well, one of the challenges for the NAACP within the African-American community was the fact that it was never an all African-American organization. It was always made up largely of, you know, white and Jewish folks and also African-Americans. In fact, the NAACP's board was mostly comprised of non-African-Americans up until 1975. So the legislative victories that it had, you know, were significant. But the NAACP, like, as in terms of the foot soldiers, in terms of the marches, the communities, it tended to be people like Dr. King, you know, who, you know, had, you know, most of the, he was out front more, you know. So you didn't really see the NAACP's leaders. You knew Roy Wilkins, but you knew of this force, you know, of this organization, but individually, you didn't know who they were. And I think that in terms of the African-American community, most people felt that the NAACP was a formidable organization to try to join. To try to get into the NAACP seemed to be cumbersome. So a lot of people started their own organizations, the Black Panthers, Operation Push, and the legislative victories had been won. You know, by 1974, most of the legislative victories had been won. And the NAACP always had a friend in the White House, Johnson, and including Nixon. Even Ford was a friend to the NAACP. But with Reagan, there was a distinct backlash. And by the 90s, the NAACP found itself on shaky financial footing. By the time Benjamin Chavis became the president of the NAACP, they were almost in financial default. And so they've been recovering ever since then.
I want to remind our listeners, Daljeet Dhaliwal is here with us for Dorje Adjoye. We were talking at the editorial meeting yesterday, just trying to assess what the relevance is of the NAACP. It's a really burning question.
Yeah, I mean, just sort of in terms of going forward, Patrick, what would you say would be the kind of the greatest challenges that you would have to face, just given, you know, sort of also in terms of the different kind of priorities that young African-American people might have these days?
Well, one of the greatest challenges for the NAACP is, what is its mission? What does it stand for? So they now have a new president, Benjamin Jealous, who's very much from the Deval Patrick, Barack Obama school. And I recall the NAACP when I was growing up in Laurinburg, North Carolina. My grandmother was a voting rights advocate, and definitely for labor laws and more inclusion in terms of factories and hirings. And I remember the passion of the foot soldiers there, and I think that passion is still there. We just have to get it to the youth, at least the members of the NAACP.
Can I ask you a question as a historian of the NAACP?
Yes.
You know, it's my impression that when Dr. King began his movement and started the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, that he was more comfortable taking a national stage under the aegis of a Christian organization, because at that time the NAACP was perceived as too radical. What a change! First of all, is that true? And is it an ironic change that the NAACP is not perceived as the radical organization anymore?
Well, John Lewis said in the 90s that he felt that white people had civil rights fatigue, and that the NAACP represented the harshest part of that fatigue. It was a reminder of all the guilt, and people were sick of feeling guilty. I think there's a reason that people feel guilty, and I think that there should be some guilty feelings, especially around some issues of civil rights. I think that in order to move the organization forward, they have to speak around universal issues like healthcare, economics, jobs, African-American male retention in schools, focusing on the problems of crime within the community. Right. They have to be honest about those issues in the way that Barack Obama was, and built a broad-based coalition that made him president of the United States.
100 years on, challenges and debates within the NAACP. Patrick Henry Bass, thank you so much for that remembrance. The NAACP turning 100, something to think about every Lincoln's birthday. Founded the organization on Lincoln's birthday. And Mark Garrison is here with a headline.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 20 minutes before the hour, also having a birthday today on the same day as Lincoln. It was Charles Darwin, so a big day for government and science this day 200 years ago. Let's get some new numbers out. Jobless claims just came out. They dropped slightly, but they're still at a 26-year high. 623,000 Americans filed for unemployment insurance, and also the claims for continuing unemployment claims, people that have been getting it for a long time, those are at a high. January was also a tough month for homeowners. The foreclosure listing service RealtyTrack says more than 274,000 homes received a foreclosure notice last month. Also, Japanese electronics company Pioneer will cut 10,000 jobs around the world. That's 16% of its workforce.
That is huge. Another sign of retail sales, which we're supposed to get later today, declining. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Daljeet Dhaliwal. Morgan Tsvangirai is confronting the harsh reality of office. The former opposition leader is now Zimbabwe's prime minister. Not only does he have the difficult job of sharing power with his rival, President Robert Mugabe, he also has to figure out how he's going to try to get the country back on track. Inflation, of course, as you know, John, is over 200%, something like 90% of the population is looking for work, and that's just for starters. To get some insight on this, we're joined by the BBC's Jonah Fisher, and he's in South Africa. Jonah, he's made a lot of promises. How much power does he actually have to make the kind of bold reforms that he's going to have to embrace?
That's really the big question. In many ways, Morgan Tsvangirai has got the impossible job. He's been given responsibility for some of the biggest problems in Zimbabwe at the moment, the economy with the finance ministry, the health ministry with hospitals in a state of collapse. But the real question is, has he been given the power and the authority to actually make a difference? That's the big unknown. We don't know how Robert Mugabe, who's been president for so long in Zimbabwe, is going to really react to having another senior leader within his government in Morgan Tsvangirai, whether it'll actually allow him to have the scope to carry out the reforms which Zimbabwe so badly needs.
So why did Mugabe give him the job then?
Well, Robert Mugabe really needed Morgan Tsvangirai to join the government to give him legitimacy. Southern African leaders had been fairly clear that after the disputed elections of last year, there should be some form of power-sharing government, that the opposition movement for democratic change should be included in the government in order for it to have legitimacy within the region. So Robert Mugabe acknowledged that that was necessary. The question always was going to be who would have responsibility for what. Initially, after those disputed elections, it was thought that Mugabe would stay on purely in a ceremonial role as president, that Morgan Tsvangirai would effectively be running Zimbabwe. The way we look at it now, it looks increasingly likely that Robert Mugabe will still call all the key shots. And the question really is, what space, if any, will Morgan Tsvangirai have to operate?
I mean, you know, the country has so many challenges. What is the view on where the money is going to come from to pay for all of this? Or is that dependent on whether the international community sees the kind of reforms that it's looking for, especially in the United States with the new administration?
Well, one of the big promises which Morgan Tsvangirai said after he was sworn in as prime minister was that he was going to pay civil servants in Zimbabwe in foreign currency. The Zimbabwean dollar has completely lost all value, and you can hardly buy anything with it. And now with that promise to pay doctors, nurses, teachers in foreign currency, the big question is, where will that money come from without any real functioning economy? Will it come from Western donors? At the moment, the United States, the European Union are saying, we want to see proof that this power-sharing government actually is about sharing power, and that Morgan Tsvangirai actually will be in control of parts of the government. So they're adopting a wait-and-see policy, so it's very hard to see where in this initial few weeks and possibly months where Morgan Tsvangirai is going to get those funds from.
So what are the first kinds of things that they want to see, and also what ministries are they contesting? What does Tsvangirai want control over that Mugabe isn't prepared to give him?
Well, finance will be a key issue. The finance minister is from the Movement for Democratic Change, but the head of the central bank in Zimbabwe is from Robert Mugabe's party, ZANU-PF. So those two key figures will have to sit together and work together to try and stabilise an economy which has been in free fall, and the currency, as I mentioned before, has completely lost all meaning.
All right, Jonah, thank you very much.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We've got Andrea Bernstein standing by to take a look at the stimulus package from a very unique perspective in a moment. Your suggestions evaluated by our Andrea Bernstein. But first, headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. And a bit of a surprise in fresh retail sales numbers just out a few minutes ago. Retail sales actually rose 1% in January. That's almost the reverse of what analysts predicted. They were expected they would drop by about the same amount. Also out earlier, the new unemployment numbers showing 623,000 new American jobs lost. That's at a high of more than two decades. January was another tough month for homeowners as well. The foreclosure service RealtyTrack says more than 274,000 homes received a foreclosure notice last month. That's down 10% from December, but still worse than this time a year ago. Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd says there will be a day of mourning for the victims of the wildfires there. Over 180 people were killed, which police believe were deliberately set in some cases. The country vowed today to push through plans for a new national fire warning system. Kabul, Afghanistan is beefing up on security ahead of a visit today from the U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke. Just yesterday, the Taliban assaulted several government buildings in Kabul. And, of course, the stimulus package could get a vote in both houses. And we're going to talk about the wish list that some of our listeners have brought to us with John and Dalton.
Well, that's a long wish list as well.
Yes, indeed. These wishes are going to become reality, Mark Garrison, and thank you for the headlines, because we're going to be taking a look at the stimulus package from the perspective of all of you who we've deputized out there, standing on the sort of sandbagging line for the economy as the stimulus package goes into localities all around the United States. We want you to be investigators, telling us how the money is being spent, and also give us suggestions, and we're going to evaluate some of those suggestions. We've chosen four already. already received from our listeners, which are characteristic of the diversity and the kinds of suggestions we've been getting. The Takeaway's own Andrea Bernstein is with us, and she will run down the likelihood of any of these great suggestions making it into the real stimulus package. First of all, Andrea, good morning.
Good morning, John.
This is pretty exciting because based on even the limited details of the stimulus bill that we have already, you still can make an assessment. And let's begin with a listener who was hoping for money to go to bridges and roads. His name is Bud Booth from Westfield, New Jersey.
They're all public works projects. They're not bridges to nowhere. Conversely, they are projects that are old and desperately need replacing. One of them is the Pulaski Skyway, which was obsolete when it was opened in the 1920s. Desperately needs rebuilding. Second is the bridge to Long Beach Island, New Jersey, which is attended by over 100,000 people every weekend during the summer. The bridge is the only way to get on and off the island, to say nothing of the way the electricity gets onto the island.
Well, thank you, Bud Booth, and he called 8778-MY-TAKE to give us a suggestion. That's great. It's so specific. I can actually see the Pulaski Skyway from the
And it's a bridge that's going
highways.
Somewhere.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Andrea, what is he going to get his wish here?
Well, he very well may. Roads and bridges did pretty well. There wasn't much difference between the House and the Senate, and some numbers that just crossed the AP wire said $27 billion would be allocated to highways and bridges, and this will go now to the governors who will be deciding the specific projects. So the upside of having no earmarks is that there are no earmarks, but the downside is that we don't know exactly what we're going to get until it goes through a state process. So Governor John Corzine in New Jersey will be making the final decision on that. However, let me just say one thing about the numbers. I got a document yesterday from that was given to me by a lobbyist who got it from a congressional staffer, and they were marking up the numbers and changing them as they go. There have been no official numbers, so we won't know until it's actually released. But right now, it looks like the number they're working with on highways and roads is $27 billion, not much down from what either the Senate or the House wanted.
And a smaller number, quite frankly, than I would have expected, given all the discussion of what stimulus actually means. But let's get to some more suggestions.
Yeah, I mean, we've been getting suggestions from all over the country. I mean, this is something that people have really kind of felt that they wanted to sort of chip in on, and they've been very responsive. So let's take a listen to another wish list from a listener.
Hi, my name is Walter Magnuson. I'm calling from Savannah, Georgia. One of the best long-term ideas of a stimulus would be the proposal out there to show America that we can build high-speed, energy-efficient trains, and that would make jobs at every level, including, you know, just manual level labor up to engineering.
So, Andrea, what do you think about that? What do you make of what Walter had to say?
High-speed rail looks like it did okay. The one thing that there was disappointment about was mass transit, which ended up getting $8.4 billion. That is pretty much exactly what the Senate was asking for, and about $4 billion less than the House wanted. The House, by the way, has a lot more people living in cities. The Senate, obviously, is representing people who are statewide. High-speed rail got about, according to the numbers just released by the AP, $8 billion. Yesterday, it looks like they were significantly lower than that. So it looks like overnight, somebody managed to get in a few more billions. But it looks like development of high-speed rail will be on the way. Inner city rail, not so great.
Very, very quickly, how would that be worked out? You mentioned Governor Corzine would decide about the Pulaski Skyway Bridge and some process that still has to be worked out. We're talking about multi-states with high-speed rail. How would that get figured out?
Well, there is a plan for various different high-speed rail systems, and I believe one of them does go to Georgia. There's also the Northeast Corridor. There's one in California. I think there are nine altogether, and the idea is to sort of create a logic to them, although obviously $8 billion, even if it is that high, is not going to go that far.
Yeah, it'll probably get you some blueprints, but maybe not an actual rail system. Here's a suggestion from Baltimore.
Good morning. My name is Carla Wynn, and I'm calling through WEAA 88.9 in Baltimore. I work in Washington, D.C. I would like to see some of the stimulus money used to create jobs for the myriad of ex-offenders I work with every single day so that they can get off the street and be employed.
Now, this is more under the category of social program stimulus. What's the chance there?
Yeah. yeah, there'll be some money for job training, probably as not as much as the listener from Baltimore wants, but there's about $5 billion total. It's divided up into many, many different programs, but there's some few hundred million in there for job training, whether it's for ex-offenders. Again, she'll have to go to talk to her governor about that.
Well, what are some of the other projects that money's been earmarked for, I mean, in terms of social projects?
Well, you know, one of the things that's really fascinating is there's been so much frustration. I was talking to one local lobbyist who was trying to figure it all out, and it's really unclear how much states will be getting. We do know this. The states were losers by this kerfuffle yesterday between the Senate and the House. The states, the governors, including Republican governors, were lobbying heavily for more aid, more direct aid, because they're facing layoffs, and they did not get what they wanted to make room for some of the tax cuts that the senators wanted to get into the bill, as well as the somewhat lower price tag.
Okay, let's squeeze in another one from Oklahoma.
My name is Lisa. I'm from Oklahoma, and I would like to see my town get a recycling program going with some of that money, or at least something for these kids to do. And I would love to be Todd Willick's intern. Go, go, Todd Willick.
That's great.
Go, go, Todd Willick.
A job program here at the Takeaway. Yes, indeed. Andrea, what's the chance of a recycling program in a municipality like Oklahoma City?
Well, Lisa, so far as I know, no direct money for recycling is a little bit of money for clean energy programs that survived. And the Todd Willick internship, I don't know about that either. But, you know, hope springs eternal.
Probably more likely to be a Todd Zwillick's intern than to get a recycling program, it sounds like what you're saying.
Under this bill, unless her governor is very, very creative with the money that's coming to Oklahoma.
Well, we can continue to investigate the likelihood of any of these suggestions from our listeners at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And Andrea, you'll be on this, on the ProPublica partnership that you're doing on our website. Give us a couple of details about that, and then we have to go.
That's right. As soon as we get more details on shovelwatch.org of the exact breakdowns, we'll be posting them and we'll be asking people for input on what they think we should be looking at in their area as this project moves forward.
And she wants to hear directly from you. The Takeaway is Andrea Bernstein. Again, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. On the way out, take our podcast to go. Catch up on the conversation we had on steroids with the New York Times' Michael Schmidt. Of course, I got people talking by saying steroids are fine. It's not cheating. It's just the world we live in. There's no way to roll back the clock. Well, a listener wrote on our website anonymously, I disagree with John. Steroids are not just like sports technology or medicine. When all the other players get better bats or sneakers or better physical therapy, you don't have to compromise your own health in order to catch up to them. Allowing steroids would introduce a dangerous arms race. My view, we're already there. But hey, it's just me. Here's your takeaway.
I recall the NAACP when I was growing up in Laurinburg, North Carolina, and I remember the passion of the foot soldiers there, and I think that passion is still there. We just have to get it to the youth.
A lot of birthdays today. That's the NAACP's 100th birthday commemoration from Takeaway contributor and Essence Magazine's Patrick Henry Bass. And, of course, the NAACP turns 100 on Lincoln's birthday, which is also the birthday of Charles Darwin. So that's sort of the takeaway deal. What do you think?
Yeah, lots of birthdays.
Yes, I mean, not the birthdays. This is the show. This is it. You've done it. You've driven in the big seat.
Oh, my word. Well, it was fun driving. I think I was kind of like driving with blinkers on.
So you were more like in the headlights, or you were the driver?
I was driving, but
excellent.
With my sort of blinkers on.
Name, please.
Daljit Dhaliwal in for Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
So what would you call this, a private sector, public sector partnership?
Basically, you come to us today on your bicycles after buying Girl Scout cookies and helping out Mother Teresa, telling us we're sorry, we didn't mean it, we won't do it again. Trust us.
Oh, that went well. Bankers on bikes, Mother T and the Girl Scouts, a congressional grilling party for bank CEOs, serves up some spicy questions and contrite executives. Looking for bankers' trust, not on Wall Street, on Capitol Hill, and The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. February 12th, 2009. Good morning. Daljeet Dhaliwal is in for Adora Udoji. You know, there actually used to be a banker's trust on Wall Street, a company called Banker's Trust.
Interesting. Good morning, everyone. I'm Daljeet Dhaliwal. I mean, it didn't sound like it was much fun for those bankers.
No. A lot of marks.
We're also going to get a fly-on-the-wall view of the tough negotiations that led to the final draft of the stimulus bill and the future of the newspaper industry. But first, let's get a check of the headlines.
Final version of the economic stimulus plan may come to a vote today. Members of Congress hashed over the eternal question yesterday. What best revives the economy, spending or tax cuts? Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says the revised version has both.
The middle ground we've reached creates more jobs than the original Senate bill and spends less than the original House bill.
So there may be actually jobs for those takers of those jobs that Senator Reid mentioned in the $789 billion bill. The Labor Department just announced that applications for unemployment last week remain close to a 26-year high. They dropped slightly from the week before to 623,000. Morning's news isn't all that bad. Retail sales rose 1% from a dismal report in December. That's almost the reverse of what analysts predicted, though.
New job losses were announced today overseas as well. Japanese electronics company Pioneer Corporation said it's going to slash 10,000 jobs globally. The company says it's anticipating an annual loss for the fifth consecutive year. And in Kabul, Afghanistan, they're stepping up security ahead of a visit from the U.S. Special Envoy to the region. Richard Holbrooke is arriving there today, and his visit comes a day after a Taliban assault on a government building in Kabul left at least 28 people dead. In Pakistan, also, has announced that it has several suspects from the Mumbai terrorist attacks in custody. It's Pakistan's first admission that planning for the attacks may have taken place on its soil. The attacks left 164 people dead.
I think around Thanksgiving, after those Mumbai attacks, no one would have thought that Pakistan and India would be so close to consensus and that the stability would be ruling supreme so far. Those attacks certainly suggested that Pakistan and India would be in a much different state than they are today. That's a huge story. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is poised to open lower despite the surprise in the retail sales. The futures trading suggests a lower open also for the S&P 500. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a stimulus bill, as I mentioned, $789 billion meant to create millions of jobs or save millions of jobs. We want your suggestion on where that stimulus money should be spent, and we're deputizing you to pay attention and investigate how it's being spent. My take at thetakeaway.org, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. It's February 12th, 2009. I'm John Hockenberry. Congress managed to get a compromise stimulus package worked out just in time for Friday the 13th. Tomorrow, Daljeet Dhaliwal is with us.
Good morning, John, and good morning, everyone. Happy to be here.
We are going to have more about the stimulus package in just a moment. The eight executives of eight banks went up to Capitol Hill, as I referred to at the top of the hour. You must have seen it yesterday. It was quite a confrontation between the members of Barney Frank's House Financial Services Committee and the major banks that have received money from the financial bailout and have had to explain what they did with the money. Well, here's a sense of what those hearings were like.
Like other states, South Carolina is struggling, and too many of my people are losing their jobs due to your actions, which have driven this economy into the ground.
It's Congressman Gresham Barrett of South Carolina's 3rd Congressional District talking about how these bankers are, as one lawmaker put it yesterday, the most hated people in America. Well, did they have an explanation for what they used the federal dollars for? Listen to John Mack, chairman and CEO of Morgan Stanley.
We have not used it to pay compensation, nor did we use it to pay any dividends or lobbying costs.
that Morgan Stanley, the most senior members of the firm, including myself, did not receive any year-end bonus in 2008.
That's John Mack, who, like the other bankers who testified yesterday, said that the money that they received from the federal government did not go to bonuses, did not go to anything, in fact, except to increase lending to consumers, which they say is actually increasing. Joining us to get a flavor of what really is an unprecedented confrontation between major bankers and lawmakers is Kate Kelly, Wall Street Journal reporter, who covered the hearing and was there yesterday. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be here.
I mean, you know, there was entertainment value there and there was history being made. Can you sort through which was which?
This is a large committee and you've got a lot of relatively junior members of the House. And so the sort of rep is that they like to ask some outrageous questions, maybe throw in something for a constituent at home so they can kind of use this material as they work with their constituents. So I think there was a little bit of a political theater factor. And of course, the subjects of their scrutiny are folks who have been really at a sort of rock bottom in terms of public opinion after getting the government bailout money, suffering the losses they have for investors and clients in the last year or two, and just kind of being knocked off their perch as masters of the universe.
Now, do you think these bankers did themselves any favors in their comportment and demeanor yesterday?
On the whole, these guys had an unenviable task. I mean, as little sympathy as people may have for them, being dragged down there and sort of publicly flogged is nothing that you'd look forward to. Some of them put quite a lot of time into preparing for this thing, like Vikram Pandit, the Citigroup chief executive. He spent apparently hours and hours reviewing his speech. He had met members of Congress just kind of to get to know them. He debated what to put in the speech, whether he ought to have this $1 salary announcement in as part of the speech. He's now going to take $1 and no bonus until the company returns to profitability. So actually, for a guy who really, really was in the hot seat, because I think he and the Bank of America chief particularly were, they've received more government money than anybody else, he did pretty well under the circumstances. Others, it was a mixed bag. I mean, I think Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan is just generally more comfortable in the spotlight, and his bank has performed relatively well during this period. So he was clearly more at ease.
Well, they weren't auditioning. They all have the part as bank executives. In some sense, Kate, this hearing is something of an inoculation for all of these men. They are collaborators with the government, ultimately trying to bring the financial sector back. We're going to leave it there. Kate Kelly, thanks so much. Wall Street Journal reporter covering that big story on Capitol Hill. But, of course, the other big story, which probably is more relevant to all of us sitting at home this morning, is the stimulus deal. Congress fought it out for about 24 hours. The final number is $789 billion. The mix of programs and spending and tax cut speaks volumes about the Democratic consensus on what to do next to stimulate the economy. Joining us now to talk about what we have here in this bill is David Herzenhorn, Washington, D.C. reporter in the Washington Bureau for our partner, The New York Times. David, thanks for joining us again.
Good morning, John.
You know, just settle one thing for me, please. How is it possible that a compromise between a Senate version, which is around $820 billion, and a House version, which is up there above $800 billion, comes in at $789?
It seems to defy the laws of gravity in Washington, right? I mean, this just doesn't happen. Bills usually go into a conference negotiation like this, and they get bigger, not smaller. And maybe in that is the way that the Obama administration will try to say, look, we are changing the ways of Washington. I don't know how true that is, but it certainly is unusual that two bills, as you described, $820 billion in the House, $838 billion in the Senate, go into negotiations where everybody has their favorite programs, what they want to spend the money on, the tax cuts that they want to offer to various constituencies in need, and they come out with a number that's substantially lower, $789 billion. Now, the challenge is that this is an economic stimulus package, and it's supposed to fill what a lot of experts are telling us will be a $2 trillion hole in the economy. So for all the compromise and the slaps on the back for, you know, sticking to a lower number, it could be at a cost of not doing as good a job in jolting the economy back to life.
Well, as you've just alluded to there, this seems like bad economics because it's not enough. It may be bad politics because of some of the programs that were left on the cutting room floor. Who lost out here?
Well, we're going to find out. I mean, we're still waiting for all the last details to be finished up. There's no question that there are a lot of folks who would have liked to see more. For instance, the Senate Republicans and many of the House Republicans wanted much more aggressive tax cutting, broader, deeper tax cuts in the income tax rates for businesses. That's not what's included in this package, although there is a substantial amount of tax provisions. So that's one area where there was some serious disagreement. Senator Johnny Isaacson of Georgia had proposed a $15,000 tax incentive for home buyers. That would have applied to all home buyers. That's now going to come down to $8,000 and apply only to first-time home buyers. We're still waiting to hear that confirmation on that final number, but it would be first-time home buyers with income limits. So there are lots of, you know, pieces here. Science research. Arlen Specter, senator of Pennsylvania, a cancer survivor, made sure that there was an extra $6.5 billion for medical research in this bill. His vote was crucial to getting it through, and so that's in there. But there was other money for other types of science research that actually got trimmed back from what was originally proposed. So it'll take a few days, Don, before we sort out exactly who the winners and losers were, and also how do you judge? Because again, any way you cut it, this is $789 billion in spending that essentially wasn't there before, right?
Right. And David, I mean, are there any other moving parts that we need to watch, that we need to have on our radar, or is this sort of the gist of it, really? I mean, not the bare bones of it, but, you know, the final version of as good as it's going to get.
Well, the broad framework is clear, and we know a lot of the details. I mean, there are pieces that individual folks are intensely interested in. For instance, the middle-class tax cut that the president proposed. Originally, the thought was that was going to provide up to $500 for individuals, up to $1,000 for couples. That's now $400 and $800. For Social Security recipients, people on disability, retirees, some veterans who are living on government support, there will be a $250 one-time payment. Obviously, that's very important to folks who aren't paying taxes and then can't claim a credit. There was a lot of interest in an incentive for car purchases. Barbara Mikulski, Senator of Maryland, had proposed allowing folks to deduct the sales tax on a car that you buy this year and the interest for the first year on financing. It looks like the sales tax portion will be in there, but you won't be able to deduct the interest on a loan. So we're going to see. But it's so big, right? There are pieces of this that will start to become clear over the next few days, you know, maybe that we haven't even noticed up until now.
And just, again, with regards to the middle-class tax cut proposal, how is this going to go down among the grassroots of the Democratic Party?
Well, it's really complicated, right? Because tax cuts are not the preferred method that Democrats were advocating to stimulate the economy. The Democrats understood and recognized that some tax cuts were necessary because they're fast acting, but there was a lot more emphasis on infrastructure spending, on investment by the government in big public works. So, you know, it's hard to know. Again, the president clearly seemed to compromise in the sense that this is a lower figure. Now, it provides less money for people to spend, and it's going to trickle out slowly. So,
well, let's focus on that in just the minute before we go. I mean, it seems to me, looking at this, and I'm looking at it pretty carefully, that one of the things that is fairly glaring is from this bill, $789 billion, there's not a America, you're now going to get a big blank, either in terms of some giant infrastructure upgrade. That's not going to happen. And we've got 13 million or more Americans unemployed, and this is anticipated to create only 3.6 million jobs.
There's no question. I mean, for the unemployed, there will be a little bit of a bigger helping hand. But I agree with you. There's a big political question about whether this needed some more punch that hits, you know, everyday Americans and says to them, hey, this is for you. It's a little bit more complicated and sophisticated than that, and will be harder for people to understand that something very big is happening for the economy, even though they might not be seeing it in their own pocketbooks.
Well, it better be sophisticated enough to turn the economy around, or there will be hell to pay in 4 years. David Herzenhorn, the first step, the stimulus package, it's passed. Final vote maybe today. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal in for Adora Udoji. So how about some of that stimulus cash to bail out the newspapers? You know, the French did it. Well, it's no huge surprise that the industry here is treading water. At least the print editions are. The readers are there, but they're migrating online where the content is free. Jeff Jarvis, professor at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism, writes about the industry in his blog, Buzz Machine, and he's here to talk about the death of newspapers and if it can or should even be averted. So, Jeff, what do you think? Do you want to kill newspapers off?
No, not really, but I think they might have killed themselves off a little too prematurely. Just before I came in on Twitter, how cool is that, I saw the news that Google just bought a paper mill in Finland. They're going to shut it down and put a data center in there. Trees are smirking. I think that newspapers shouldn't concentrate on being paper, and that's the problem they've had. They've had 15 years since the commercial browser was released in October 1994. To figure out this world. But like so many other industries, auto, banking, they try to protect their past as a strategy for the future. The truth is that the web brings incredible new opportunities to cover, to gather, share news in all kinds of new ways. Now, can the legacy players really take advantage of that? Some will. But this year, with the dire straits in the industry, newspapers are going to die. And what matters is what's going to go in their place.
There's a downside to consuming news in that way as well. I mean, how do you sort of move beyond this whole thing of it just being, you know, page impression upon page impression and bring value to it?
Oh, I think it's quite possible. I think that aggregation and curation of the news becomes a value. And there's so much more news from so many more places. I can now read and write for The Guardian in London, the BBC, NPR, all these places bring it together and get the best of the world now. So the question becomes, what opportunities lie there? Among them is to be a curator, to find the best news, to add value in that way. Another is that I think we're going to create networks of journalism where a lot of players in a larger ecosystem will add to journalism. And part of the value there, I think, is to help educate them to do it better.
Well, those are all nice volunteer positions. The question is, who will pay for what? And are there revenue streams that can even compare to what the New York Times needs to fund its infrastructure? Let's take a couple of headlines from the Times. Carlos Slim, the billionaire from Mexico City in the telecom industry, has taken apparently a $250 million position of stock with the New York Times. The Times is trying to sell its interest in the Boston Red Sox to raise cash. Sign of desperation there. And then Murdoch, the other big player in newspapers here in the United States, News Corp lost $6 billion in its last report. Are these new signs that things are accelerating?
Yes, I think that's exactly what's happening. It's acceleration, but the trend is already there. The Times itself, I think, is in decent shape. The Boston Globe is in dire shape. Regional papers across the U.S. are in terrible shape, too, and I think that some will die. But again, I think the question is, I just wrote a book called What Would Google Do? And I've been asking, it started with the idea of telling newspaper people to ask that question, to think about their world as Google would. Now, what they have to do is to distribute their news and get it out in all kinds of new ways. They don't have to own everything. That was the necessity of owning the press, which just doesn't exist anymore. So the idea that a major paper has to have, every paper has to have their own golf critic and movie critic and this and that, they don't have to be all things to all people anymore. The internet brings a very different sized business, probably smaller, definitely smaller, but also possibly more profitable.
But what's also going on in terms of, you know, how we look at newspapers, how we value newspapers? I mean, if you look at President Sarkozy, I mean, he decided to bail out the French newspapers. I mean, I bet that kind of dialogue isn't happening in the United States about whether we should be. Yeah, I mean, I know that you probably don't feel that it should be. But my question is, like, what's changed in terms of how we... our relationship to newspapers? I mean, is there something that's happening in terms of how we value journalism?
Newspapers have more readers than ever. They have more readers than ever. The New York Times has readers all around the world right now.
So, which is ironic. So they're not profitable,
but they're not living
but their readership is up.
They're not living in a scarcity economy anymore where they controlled the asset of the press and could set prices. Well, we're in an abundance economy, and Google knows how to take advantage of that where newspapers don't. They're just in very different mindsets.
But Google's all about control. I mean, the model that you're talking about, what would Google do? Google will be the gigantic information monopoly. No, they don't control the means of production of content, but they essentially control the means of distribution in terms of search and you know, they're the huge player out there. They know what all of us are doing, why we're searching for what, and they're aggregating that information. That's 10 revenue streams right there. Your argument suggests there won't be many players in journalism anymore. They'll just be Google, and if you play by their rules, you're in. Otherwise, forget it.
No, look at Google itself. Google is actually a platform. Google doesn't own all the internet. The more content that is created on the internet, the better off it is for Google. The more they have to organize, the more they have to put ads on. Why shouldn't a paper look at it that way? So here in New York, you have Debbie Gallant starting BaristaNet, a great blog in New Jersey, covering a town there, getting 10,000 visitors a day, 100 advertisers. The relationship of the Star Ledger or the New York Times to Debbie should be to join in a network. Debbie can own her thing, they can own their thing, and the larger platform can help make her business work. That's the way to look at it now.
Let's talk about this free content for a minute. I mean, there seems to be a big debate going on about whether or not you should or shouldn't charge for this. I mean, what are your thoughts on it? I mean, do you think that this is sort of going towards a new business model which could in some way sort of help the survivability of journalism if, you know, in 10 or 15 years there aren't going to be any more newspapers?
The New York Times failed with Times Select, or it chose to kill it down. And when they did shut it down, their traffic went up 40%. But more, and their columnists were back in the conversation. Tom Friedman hated being behind a paywall. But most important of all, the New York Times gained Google juice. If you try to charge for content, you gain a lot of costs. You have to market, number one, and number two, you shut yourself off from the world of search. And that is suicidal. I think companies will soon be valued on their Google juice. And by shutting down the paywall and going back to free, the Times increased the value of its asset and reached more people.
And Jeff, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest was Jeff Jarvis, professor at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism, with a new book called What Would Google Do? And here's Mark Garrison with the latest news.
And share that Google juice, Mark.
Yeah, I don't drink this early in the morning, but thank you, Daljit. It's 28 minutes after the hour. Two new key economic indicators are just out last hour. The number of people filing new unemployment claims dropped slightly from the previous week. That's at 623,000. But again, remember, that is near a 26-year high on unemployment. Also, U.S. retail sales jumped 1% in January. That was a surprise to economists. They were expecting them to go down. The January report shows certain big box outlet sales went up, but sales were down at department stores. Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, is brimming with government troops ahead of a visit from the new U.S. special envoy to the region. It will be Richard Holbrooke's first visit to the region in his new post. Yesterday in Kabul, a Taliban assault on several government buildings left dozens dead. The Obama administration plans to send some 30,000 new American troops to Afghanistan. Holbrooke, of course, is coming from this week's visit to Pakistan. China's state-owned aluminum producer Chinalco says it will invest almost $20 billion in giant mining company Rio Tinto. That company is nearly $40 billion in the red. It would be the biggest ever overseas investment by a Chinese company if that deal is approved.
It's a buyer's market for commodities.
They want resources.
It's really interesting, and that's going to be a huge story in the future. Thank you, Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Wall Street has just opened. The Dow and S&P have tumbled between 1% and 2% right off the bat. Is it a response to the stimulus program? I don't know. It's Wednesday, February 12th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Daljit Dhaliwal, who's in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Daljit.
Good morning to you, John.
So we're having a stimulating conversation with you reacting to the stimulus package, just like Wall Street is. What is in the $789 billion stimulus bill that would help your town or city?
Hi, my name is Mary Catherine Sudiak. I'm calling from Cranford, New Jersey. I'm really hoping that while they cut a lot of money for the funding of school construction, that there still may be an ability for schools to be able to do things like replace leaky roofs and replace them with roofs with solar power on them.
8778MyTake or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can suggest stimulus projects and we'll evaluate their likelihood to actually get done. And did I say it was Wednesday? No, it is Thursday, because Wednesday night a very important sports story happened in Columbus, Ohio. And Carlos Gonzalez, a reporter for the local CBS affiliate in Columbus, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you, John. How you doing?
So, you know, I'm doing great. And normally we wouldn't spend a lot of time talking about sports and Columbus unless maybe, you know, the Blue Jackets, the NHL hockey team,
right,
you know, maybe took a wrong turn and missed a game somewhere. But right. But boy, we have a gigantic World Cup soccer story right in your neck of the woods. In about as long as it takes to actually play a soccer game,
right,
22,000 tickets were sold for the game last night between the USA and Mexico. You were there. What was it like?
It was electric, really. I mean, folks started showing up from all over the place, internationally as well. You know, there were folks that showed up from 43 different states, Washington, D.C., Canada, and Mexico. And the partying, no kidding, began on Tuesday afternoon. A lot of the local soccer pubs here in town were just packed right off the bat. Folks closed down the pubs. They were back again yesterday right around midday, and just fans all over the place. It was really, really something else. You know, we've got a pretty good soccer fan base here in Columbus for our professional team, the Columbus Crew. We just won the national title. By the way, heads up.
That's good. Congratulations. And you know, it's a huge football town, Columbus, with Ohio State.
Right.
How did the interest in this game rival the you know, perennial interest in Ohio State?
Well, that's the big thing, is that you know, our fan base for soccer here, we've got a good one for the Crew. It's going to be a lot smaller than Ohio State. You know, football, the following is for that. But what the big thing was with this is that you know, instead of just having folks that would come into town from, you know, surrounding Ohio towns, some folks come up from Nashville, you know, a few surrounding areas to travel in for Ohio State games as fans. But this one, it was just such a larger draw from people from, you know, all the way out on the West Coast. You know, I talked to a lot of folks around that had traveled in. We had folks from Pittsburgh, of course, from up in Connecticut, folks that traveled up from Florida, from Georgia, talked to a group of guys from Southern California that had made the trip up. So there was definitely a big contingency
huge
of travelers
influx
for this game.
You know, as a reporter at the CBS affiliate there in Columbus, how much of the local community was invigorated by a rivalry between Team USA and Mexico?
Well, locally, it's a big deal. I mean, number one, for the soccer fans, of course, they all know about the big rivalry between the U.S. and Mexico. It's been a rivalry that's been going on since, you know, the 1930s. And it's really one of the bigger ones in international soccer. A lot of that, we did our best to kind of expose exactly what that was for soccer fans, to kind of teach, you know, the local community of folks who are just kind of getting interested in the fact that there is a World Cup match going on here in town, or a World Cup qualifying match here in town. So we talked a lot about that as a media outlet, to kind of let people know, hey, you know, here's the history, you know, between the U.S. and Mexico, especially the significance of 2-0, or it's a big chant that a lot of the fans drop during the games, which is 2-0. Big deal behind that is that in the past decade, the U.S. has beat Mexico by that score multiple times. It's been kind of a big deal. We ended up, of course, beating them in the qualifier in 2001, 2-0 there. During the actual FIFA World Cup in Korea, 2-0 there. And then during the qualifying match right here in Columbus in 2005, again, 2-0. And then, well, last night's game kind of wrapped that up with another 2-0 win.
Yeah, I was holding back the score there. 2-0. USA
yes.
is up in this round. I mean, for your local viewers and listeners, Carlos Gonzalez, did you have to disclose your own sort of identity as far as a fan is concerned? Is it Mexico or USA?
Oh, it's USA. You know, I'm from the desert Southwest. I'm from New Mexico, though. You know, I did grow up in a bilingual household, and my mother actually Mexico fan, and much
Whoa.
To my father's dismay, because he's a U.S. fan. And they actually sent me an email. They're in Mexico right now, and they watched the game last night in Mexico. They had also watched the qualifying round in 2005 in Mexico. Funny story here, though. My father sent the email. He said, this time around, we're not going to watch in a Mexican bar. We're going to go to a Canadian bar, because after the win last time when they were down there, they said that it got a little rambunctious and a little scary for them. And so they said, this year, great. We're going to watch the qualifying round in Mexico in a Canadian bar.
That's the passion of the World Cup. Talk quickly about the Michael Brady's performance. Two goals. That was a huge score.
It really is. You know, he's one of only four individuals who has scored two games against Mexico as part of the U.S. men's team. The guy's only 21 years old. Phenomenal athlete. This guy is just really good. First one he made toward the end of the first half, and then just before the end of the second half was when he's put in that that second goal. So really big deal. Guy's an awesome athlete. You know, great to watch.
I can certainly hear the passion in your voice. Carlos Gonzalez, reporter at WBNS, the local CBS affiliate in Columbus, Ohio, talking about the significance in terms of fan frenzy and the score itself. Team USA over Mexico 2-0 in Columbus, Ohio last night. Thanks, Carlos, and thanks for the tip on Canadian bars in Mexico. That's something good to watch out for. I've never seen one, actually, in Mexico, a Canadian bar.
Canadian food, pretty good. Good beer.
Yeah. Well,
poutine.
Sure.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know if they have the Montreal French style. We'll see.
Mark Garrison has the headlines.
I sure do.
And more tips on bars in Mexico.
21 minutes before the hour. We'll stay in sports just for a minute just to say that legendary NFL quarterback Brett Favre is retiring again.
Oh, he's really good at that.
Well, yeah. I know you got it twice as nice. We'll see. But he retired for Green Bay in 2008, came back and led the New York Jets. Didn't go that well, but he did have a good career before that. A House vote is possible today on the big economic stimulus package lawmakers agreed to last night. The White House is considering a primetime signing ceremony when it comes to the president's desk. The agreement on tax cuts and spending has been pared to $789 billion. Lawmakers thinned it out in negotiations last night. Egyptian police arrested 40 suspected smugglers in a new crackdown on smuggling into the Gaza Strip. An Egyptian official said hundreds of security forces have been deployed in and around the border. Israel is demanding a halt to weapons smuggling. Gazans rely on underground tunnels to Egypt to get outside goods. Here in the U.S., cleanups day after severe weather lashed several states. There's also high wind warnings across the country this morning. I'll give you a story that has Wikipedia, the British House of Commons, and Renaissance painting. Let's just listen to Conservative leader David Cameron in the UK.
The Prime Minister never gets his facts right. He told us the other day he was like Titian, age 90. The fact is Titian died at 86.
Little problem
there.
That's
a big controversy.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So actually what happened where they're under fire is because someone in the Conservative Party went and changed the Wikipedia entry to make that correct, when there's actually no scholarly consensus on how old Titian was when he died.
Too much free time.
They tried to make it reality.
Thank you, Mark Garrison, on the Titian controversy here on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Daljit Dhaliwal, in for Adora Udojin. Now, more on that Pakistani story that we've been following in our news briefs with Mark, and he just talked about the fact that for the first time, Pakistan has said that some of the Mumbai terror attacks were planned on their soil. Officials say that several suspects are being held. Alan Cowell is following this story for our partner, The New York Times. He's a senior correspondent of NewYorkTimes.com and he's based in Paris. Alan, thanks so much for doing this for us. What are the Pakistani authorities saying? What more have they said about the way that these attacks were planned and these suspects that they're holding?
Well, this does seem to be quite the fullest account that I've heard so far of exactly what happened and the extent to which Pakistan or Pakistani nationals and Pakistani territory were involved. I mean, perhaps the most startling of these disclosures today from the Pakistan Interior Ministry is that part of the plot was actually hatched on Pakistani soil, which is something Pakistan was very reluctant to acknowledge at the time of the attacks.
Why the change of heart then?
I think there's a lot of tension at the moment. We've got a new administration in Washington. Nobody wants in that region, I don't think, wants this to spin out of control. The Indian authorities have been getting more and more angry at the absence of results from the Pakistani investigation. You know, at the same time as this press conference was held in Pakistan today, which to explain these new disclosures. Richard Holbrooke, President Obama's new envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, had just been visiting. So I think there's a degree of a desire by Pakistan to show willing, to show goodwill, and to hope that, that it will not be accused in future of dragging its heels.
And how is India likely to respond to this? I mean, do they want these suspects extradited?
That hasn't emerged yet. I think there's a sense of vindication. The Indian authorities do seem to be initially playing it cautiously. They're saying, well, let's get official notification of this. Let's see the documents. And once we've done that, we'll respond. But there is a sense of satisfaction, I think, that everything India has said from the very beginning, that this was closely orchestrated from Pakistani territory, has now come to pass and now been vindicated.
And here's the thing. President Zardari of Pakistan said that there was no, he was talking about no state complicity. He spoke about sort of non-state actors. What kind of impact is this likely to have on his civilian government?
No one so far has gone so far as to say that to fully confirm that what the Indian accusation is, which is, if you remember, that official agencies was the word that was used, the idea that the Pakistani intelligence services or parts of the Pakistan intelligence services would have been involved in this. That's not what's being said today. And until that's cleared up, I think that the real background to this will probably remain rather murky.
All right. Alan Cowell of our partner, the New York Times, following this story for us. He's a senior correspondent of NewYorkTimes.com based in Paris. Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. 200 years ago today, the Lincoln family and the Darwin family welcomed Charlie and little Abe into the world. More about the dual birthdays in a moment with Adam Gopnik of the New Yorker magazine. But we've got a sell-off on Wall Street, 2% down on the S&P and the Dow in reaction to the stimulus package. Mark Garrison, you got the headlines?
Yeah, a lot of tough economic news. January was another tough month for homeowners. The foreclosure service RealtyTrack says more than 274,000 homes received a foreclosure notice last month. That is a 10% improvement over December's numbers, but again, still worse than this time a year ago. Pope Benedict is clearly condemning Holocaust denial. He met with Jewish leaders today. The Vatican is under fire for bringing a controversial bishop back into the Catholic Church. That bishop has repeatedly questioned the Holocaust. The Vatican says the Pope did not know about his Holocaust views. The Pope also says he'll visit Israel. The Ukrainian ship that was released by Somali pirates just arrived in Kenya today. It will deliver its load of tanks and thousands of rounds of ammunition. There's been controversy over the cargo. Kenyan authorities say it's intended for their nation's army, but some documents indicated the weapons may have been ultimately intended for Sudan. The ship was held captive and released only after a $3.2 million ransom paid. There are high wind warnings across the country today. This after winds sometimes gusting to hurricane strength. The tour through the Midwest and East last night. A severe thunderstorm collapsed a gym in West Virginia. John, Donald.
A foul weather week here. Mark Garrison, Julie, thank you very much for the headlines. With the last headlines for this hour, we're going to take it out with Adam Gopnik. We referred to the dual birthday of Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln 200 years ago, born today. Historical figures of monumental proportions. Adam Gopnik, of course, staff writer for The New Yorker for 20 years, author of most recently Angels and Ages, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life. Adam Gopnik, how is it the case that I've gone through my entire life and not known, really until this week, that Lincoln and Darwin were born on the exact same day?
John, I had written essays for The New Yorker about both of them before I knew that they were born on the same day. I was late arriving at this understanding. It just is one of those little bits of cosmic coincidence that somehow haven't been incorporated fully into our minds until now. I hope it will be.
Well, this coincidence you weave into a very powerful narrative thread of these two voices, these two personalities, really heralding the coming of an age. What do you think that age is?
I think it's our age, John. It's the age of modernity, and particularly the age of moral modernity. And by that, I mean the time in which people simultaneously struggle to hold on to their beliefs and their values, the values of family, the values of nation, the values of compassion, emancipation, altruism, and at the same time realize that those values can only take place, first of all, in a universe, on a planet, as Darwin showed, that has an immeasurably long time span, and where we're not here because somebody wanted us here. We're here because of a series of accidents and events in a long book of life, and where even in our own more narrow world, the only way, as Lincoln showed, that we can defend some of our most powerful and important values is by fighting for them, by fighting and killing. So that is what I think of as moral modernity, that double consciousness, John, that we have good values, but that we can't anchor them in anything solid, and we may have to commit violence in their defense.
Why are these two individuals not, as history often likes to characterize them, as people who stepped away from or repudiated the world of faith and fear?
Well, they have an interesting kind of double track. Lincoln is fascinating, John, because he begins as an absolute village atheist free thinker making fun of the Bible, and he has to apologize, if you remember, for being a free thinker to when he runs for office for the first time. And yet, through the course of the war, through the course of his own suffering, losing his favorite son, Willie, in the middle of the war, he moves towards a kind of private mysticism, a state of mind that I compare to Job's in the Old Testament. That is, he knows that hundreds of thousands of people have died. He knows that death is all around him. And he doesn't have remorse for it. He doesn't think he's done the wrong thing. But at some deep level, he has to believe that God has a purpose, which is still mysterious to Lincoln. Darwin travels just the opposite way around. He begins training as a minister, and he has a kind of quiet, complacent Anglican faith. And then through his discovery of evolution and of deep time, and then through the loss of his beloved daughter, Annie, when she's 10, he gives up his faith completely and becomes a kind of stoical, contemplative philosopher of time and life. And it strikes me, John, the important thing about that is there are very few modern people who haven't arrived at one or another of those places. We either tend to have a deeply internalized sense of providence and fate that we call God, or else we tend to be stoic, agnostic observers of the long stretches of time in history. So Darwin and Lincoln are very modern in that way.
You know, the ancients certainly spent a lot of time thinking about creation and thinking about what happened in the beginnings of the world and the universe. Yet it is Darwin's understanding of what you call deep time that truly provides insights that get us close to the truth of what happened. Explain this notion of deep time and how it was conveyed to readers who really were coming to something very, very unfamiliar.
That's exactly right. Deep time was an idea that geologists had first. They had realized that the Earth had to be very, 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 very old, not thousands of years old, as was believed, but millions and tens of millions of years old in order for all of the strata of rocks to have been there. And Darwin seized on that understanding and said, that gives us incredibly long stretches of time for in which life could have evolved. And so when he's asking you in On the Origin of Species to believe in his theory, and he argues for it with great wit and cunning, he says, look, you accept that dogs can go from being great big woofy things to tiny little yappy things in the space of a few generations. And everybody says, yeah. I said, we all know how that's done, and that's done in almost no time at all. Now imagine if you had an almost immeasurable span of time and you had nature doing what the dog breeder does. That was the key leap that Darwin was able to make. He was able to see that because we have so much time in which evolution can take place, that things that might seem crazy, like the evolution of an eye or a wing, become possible and even inevitable.
And indeed, this way of thinking about things in scales, in scaling up or scaling down, is really the beginnings of all kinds of scientific thought in terms of physics and technology that we're dealing with sort of on a daily basis today. But let me end by asking you a question about Lincoln. You really turn my head around about Abraham Lincoln, who I really, when I came to this book, I thought to myself, well, Darwin is a writer, Lincoln is a doer. How's he going to weave these two together? You really convinced me that not only is Lincoln a writer, but he's perhaps the first person in America who understood our founding documents as speaking to the ages, as opposed to simply speaking to the English king. He saw in it the profundity that is familiar to us today.
Yes, that's right. He saw, and Gary Wills, I should add, has made this point in the past, he saw that the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson's writing, was our real bedrock, that the Constitution was a legalistic, and he loved legalism, interpretation of it. But that's what you should keep coming back to. One of the most profound moments in American history is when he's engaged in a debate with Stephen Douglas, who's a really ugly racist. And Douglas is saying the races can never be on a footing of equality. What are you talking about? And Lincoln is a politician, so he says, I don't know about a footing of equality, but I know that from the point of view of the Declaration of Independence, from the black man's right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, his right to those things is as great as Mr. Douglas's, as mine, or of any white man in the room. That's a moment when what had simply been a piece of 18th century curlicue in people's minds suddenly once again became a living document. And it's Lincoln's way towards emancipation.
Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln, born on the same day 200 years ago. You got any plans for the 200th, Adam Gopnik?
I'm heading home, John, and that which should be good. I'm heading home, and we'll have a cake. And, you know, I don't want to pretend that these two guys just sort of live in some neat, isolated parallelisms. We could look at a lot of people from their time. But, boy, when you think about what they did, they gave optimism, the optimism of liberalism, a tragic conscience that gave us a way of speaking and writing in plain English that still enabled us to say very deep and subtle things. I don't want to be too much of a hero worshiper, but if you're going to worship heroes, these guys are good.
Angels and Ages is the title, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life. The author is Adam Gopnik, staff writer for The New Yorker for over 20 years. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you, John.
Well-chosen heroes there. And on the way out, we want to remind you that you can join the conversation here on The Takeaway, especially when you clarify things. I mentioned earlier in the program that Carlos Slim took a $250 million stake in the New York Times Corporation. Actually, Richard writes on our website, Carlos Slim did not take an equity stake in the Times. He lent them $250 million at 14% interest. Please be careful, Richard said. Thanks for adding that detail. It's actually a very complicated deal. We urge you to research it. We've been tracking the stimulus bill all week. We've been compiling this great to-do list from all of you, places you think the money will be spent. RJ writes on our site, I'd like to see more money to keep libraries open on Sundays and late into the evening, and for more staff to work with children and especially with adults for computer training. Tell us what you want to stimulate in your town. We really want the specifics. We're in a position to estimate and assess the probability that any of those could actually be part of the stimulus bill. We also want you to be part of our investigative reporting team on the stimulus bill as the money is spent. Go to our website to find out how. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Daljit Dhaliwal, in for Adora Udoji.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.